Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director, Dr. Nicholas Pennings, interviews Dr. Ariana Chow, a keynote speaker from Obesity Medicine 2020 Virtual, about the role behavioral interventions play in lifestyle change. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Eat this, not that. Dietary programs typically focus extensively on what you eat. Low carb, low fat, high protein. There's no shortage of opinions on what is best. There are plant-based diets, there are carnivore diets. But it's not just about what we eat. Why we eat is just as important, if not more important, than what we eat. Most food decisions are driven by emotions, stress, boredom, cravings, impulse, celebration, morning, eve, and the drive for hedonic pleasure of food are all powerful influences on our food choices. As a result, the behavioral interventions play a vital role in any successful lifestyle intervention. Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair of Family Medicine, the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine, and Executive Director of Clinical Education at the Obesity Medicine Association. I have with me Dr. Ariana Chow. She is assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing and at the Center for Weight and Eating Disorders at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Chow earned her PhD in nursing from Yale University. Her research is focused on identifying biobehavioral mechanisms related to binge eating disorder and disordered eating. She's particularly interested in the role of stress, reward, and food cravings in obesity and obesity-related metabolic abnormalities. Dr. Chow was a keynote speaker at the OMA virtual conference held in May 2020. She presented on incorporating behavioral health into the PCP's office. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Chow.
Thanks so much for having me.
So nurses play an integral part in healthcare in many roles, including hospital and office practices. I work with a nurse, and beyond her nursing role, she serves as a health coach, diabetes educator, first-line support for many of my patients on their weight loss journey. You started your health career in nursing, progressing to a PhD in nursing. What do you see as some of the key roles that nurses and nurse practitioners play in the management of patients with obesity?
So nurses and nurse practitioners are well equipped to play several key roles in the management of patients with obesity. They're situated in a wide range of different settings and consequently have the potential to provide health-promoting activities that contribute to weight management in diverse patients. Nurses are often one of the initial contacts and really set the stage for first impressions regarding weight management. They play a key role in identifying and assessing weight status at an office visit, and private weighing that's really respectful and non-judgmental can really set the tone for weight management that's provided and give patients more positive impressions about their experiences. Nurses and NPs are also really well positioned to intervene and counsel patients regarding obesity, as well as prescribing weight loss medications in the case of nurse practitioners. They can also provide referrals to other tertiary services such as bariatric surgery and can provide basic opportunities for healthy lifestyle advice and providing behavioral weight loss counseling. In addition, nurses and NPs also play critical roles in conducting research related to obesity as well as for advocating policy changes.
I think the first impression part is an important one, because they are often the face of the office, and they help to build that first impression. And certainly, being able to make a patient at ease and avoiding bias and stigma is very important in that initial encounter. Do you, in working with nurses in other offices or in your clinical setting, do you do any special training for stigma and bias for your staff?
Yeah, so I think it's important that when we are training new providers, as well as throughout sort of our clinical experiences, that we're sort of aware and able to talk about different experiences that might have been uncomfortable or also ways to improve our clinical care for different patients. We actually have a researcher here, Rebecca Pearl, who does work on stigma related to obesity. So we get a lot of great training and insight from her as well.
Absolutely. She must be a tremendous resource, very well recognized in the field. Eat less, exercise more. That's the common advice that's given. I live in North Carolina, and here they say, eat smart, move more. But the message is the same. It's all about calories in and calories out. But a fundamental question I think needs to be asked is, why are calories in greater than calories out? What happens when we create a negative calorie balance? How does our mind and body respond to that? And what role does behavioral health play in managing calories in and calories out?
So that's a great question, really fundamental to a lot of obesity treatment. So essentially, when people gain weight, it's often a result of very small deviations from energy balance. Even 1 to 2% of daily energy intake can result in really drastic long-term weight changes. So obesity often occurs in a way that's really insidious and sometimes undetectable. So people might gradually put on weight sort of a few ounces at a time. So if someone says, consumes about 20 excess calories per day, that'll cause an average person to gain about 2 pounds per year or 10 pounds in 5 years. And these small amounts are really hard for people to recognize or even keep track of. So we know that the food environment's really obesogenic. So there are a lot of different sorts of strategies that we'll use in behavioral treatment for obesity to help people to manage these different influences in the environment. We also know that external factors and sort of the built environment also have a really large role in terms of contributing to the obesity epidemic. Things that make our life a lot easier, like email, as well as public transportation, are really great in terms of labor saving. However, the shortcuts also make it really hard to get the physical activity that's needed to lose weight, as well as to help mitigate any sort of weight gain that happens. So again, addressing these in behavioral weight loss treatment is really important, and kind of addressing different strategies that people can use to make the built environment really work for them.
Yes, I think those are important things to consider, and that the average person only gains in midlife about 1 pound a year. So that translates to just 10 extra calories a day, which is such a small amount. So building in those routines and building in those habits that help you to increase your activity and decrease your intake are important. You utilize intensive behavioral therapy in your management of patients with obesity. Describe what that is and how you apply it in your practice.
So intensive behavioral treatment for obesity is kind of what it sounds like. So it's kind of seeing patients regularly enough that they'll be getting an adequate dose of the treatment. And usually that's defined as at least 14 sessions over about 6 months. And behavioral treatment is essentially a package of different principles and techniques that really aim to help patients make long-term changes in their eating behaviors and physical activity. It includes different things like self-monitoring their food intake, as well as their weight and physical activity, different things like stimulus control, as well as different sort of problem solving and cognitive restructuring strategies.
So what are some ways that a solo practitioner or a small group practitioner can implement the IBT model program?
Sure. There's a number of different curriculum that can be used. I think that providers can just sort of print out different materials that they can use with patients. I think that really helps to structure the visits and also provides patients with something tangible that they can look at and sort of follow along with. So in terms of implementation, we've learned, I think, a lot from programs like the Diabetes Prevention Program that included a lot of lifestyle counseling in terms of implementing these into clinical practice. And it can be challenging. I think having buy-in from the practice is really, really important. So having some sort of clinical champion that kind of, you know, spearheads the program, as well as looking at, you know, different quality improvement once the program is sort of up and running inside of a clinic. Looking at things like infrastructure, sustainability, things like cost, reimbursements, making sure that success measures are also being looked at as well as important in terms of implementing any sort of new program.
Are there any community resources that you can think of that might be helpful?
Sure. So there's a number of different community programs, like the YMCAs oftentimes have different programs for lifestyle modification. There's also commercial programs that are evidence-based that also can help to provide weight loss management.
And what about large groups? Is there a particular strategy that might be different for a larger group?
Sure. So I think for large groups, a lot of obesity treatment is very multidisciplinary. So I think some of the larger groups might lend themselves towards that. So having sort of, if there's an exercise physiologist or a dietitian available at the practice, that can be really useful. Also kind of doing groups. So we know group-based treatment oftentimes is as effective as individual one-on-one based treatment, and often adds additional benefits in terms of being more resource or less resource intensive, and also gives patients a lot of great social support and sort of a healthy dose of competition, which can be really rewarding for participants as well.
Well, that's good. And you provided a curriculum at the conference of the curriculum that you use in your program, and the DPP resources are available, are they not?
Yes, correct. So the DPP ones, as well as the Look Ahead group. Has some as well available. And it's great too, because those, the DPP and Look Ahead resources often come with counselor manuals. So they have some language available too that can help providers in terms of structuring different conversations with patients, as well as some information too about leading groups. The model program, from the University of Pennsylvania, spearheaded by Dr. Tom Wadden. That is particularly structured for individual one-on-one sort of primary care visits that would occur in about 15 minutes or so. So the structure is a little bit different in terms of content.
Okay. Those are great resources and can be found online as well. One of the challenges in managing patients with obesity centers around setting a weight goal. As clinicians, we recognize that a 5 to 10% weight loss can produce significant health benefits. Patients, however, often want to return to a weight that they were at a different time in their life. That goal may not be realistic or even healthy at this point in their lives. How do you manage patients where you are concerned about mismatched goals?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so this happens fairly commonly. We often
daily.
Call them stretch goals, yes. I find it really helpful not to really focus and kind of harp on the discrepancy between sort of the patient's ideal goal and what's realistic, and really focus more on factors that are predicting successful outcomes. So things like consistent self-monitoring is really, really important. I also, though, encourage patients really to that gradual, healthy, and reasonable changes in their eating and physical activity that they can sustain over the long term, and to really break these larger weight loss goals into smaller goals of about 1 to 2 pounds or so per week, and encourage people really to, you know, set SMART goals, so ones that are more manageable and measurable over the long term.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, to break it down into smaller, more easily achieved goals and build on there. That often builds a sense of self-efficacy as well and helps patients move forward. I also find sometimes when we undershoot a goal, the patient is more likely to exceed it. Negative self-talk. It's something that we all do, often without realizing it. Patients with obesity may particularly have strong negative self-talk associated with harsh self-criticism. Such negative self-talk is often very demoralizing and demotivating. Do you address negative self-talk with patients? And if so, how do you work with patients to recognize and modify negative self-talk?
Absolutely. So we know that negative thoughts really can undermine weight loss efforts, and they can really be self-defeating. So it's important to address them. So we might hear from patients saying that this program really isn't working anymore, and they might really feel very defeated, feel a sense of failure, and might give up on their weight loss goals and really stop seeing the provider for weight loss. So I help patients oftentimes to develop what we call a more rational response and to kind of talk back to these negative thoughts. So for example, if it's someone who comes in and really thinks that this really is not working anymore, I might encourage them to kind of think a more rational thought. So maybe restructure to think that although losing weight really feels difficult right now, it's natural to face some sort of obstacles and weight plateaus. And I encourage them to continue their self-monitoring as well as to continue to, eat a healthy diet as well as exercise. And hopefully kind of by recognizing when these negative thoughts occur and kind of developing a more rational response, they kind of have more encouragement and they might recognize that sort of periodic struggles are normal and really recommit to tackling these obstacles. But again, it's really important to address these oftentimes because patients might not actually realize that they're having these thoughts and they might not realize how these are influencing their overall weight loss goals.
Yeah, and they need to recognize that challenges will occur along the way and how to navigate those challenges are really important. Another situation we sometimes hear people is, I ate a cookie, I blew my diet. I guess it doesn't matter what I eat today. This is something that people will commonly think, say, and that in turn undermines. And as a result, small deviations from their nutritional interventions are turned into catastrophes. How do you help patients prevent from turning lapses into something more than it really is?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that is also very, very common. And I usually, like to tell patients early on that, you're not going to necessarily be successful every day, and kind of having these slips or temporary setbacks is, a normal part of the weight loss and long-term weight loss process. So really the key is to learn how to respond when they do occur. So this I typically do in four steps. So the first one is recognizing the difference between a slip and a relapse. So a relapse would essentially be when the patient really decides to give up and really not commit to healthy eating or being active. And after a long period of time, a slip can turn into this relapse, especially if it's not caught early. But again, patients should know that they can recover from a slip, similar to a golfer who recovers from a bad tee shot. In terms of step two, it would be identifying triggers for the slip. So patients should determine sort of what factors make a slip especially likely to occur. Step three would be creating an action plan for what to do differently in the future to prevent that type of slip. And step four would be sort of adjusting, their calorie intake if necessary and determining if they need to, say, increase their self-monitoring or increase their physical activity over the next several days.
Yeah, and also trying to move patients away from that black and white thinking. I'm either perfect or it's pointless to do this. And that's a big challenge. Many people have that kind of thinking, and it poses it really interferes with their success.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I also tell people that the only people who ever fail are the people who stop trying, and everybody else is a work in progress, right?
Yeah.
So one last question. What is your favorite bit of advice to providers who treat patients with obesity?
Yeah, so I think one of my favorite bits of advice is, you know, I'm sure I'm, you know, preaching to the choir here, but making sure providers realize it's not necessarily a diet, it's a lifestyle change. So, you know, a number of different techniques, different types of diets can be used to help patients achieve their weight loss goals. But it's really important to have discussions with patients to figure out what's going to work for them in the long term, and to identify things that they'll be able to, again, live with long term.
Absolutely. One size does not fit all, and we need to individualize our treatments with our patients. Well, thank you very much for being with us today, and thank you very much for your presentation at the 2020 virtual conference, and look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Pennings and Chow. For more information about Obesity Medicine Podcast and other resources from the clinical leader in obesity medicine, please visit obesitymedicine.org/podcast. Love this episode of Obesity, a Disease? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. The views expressed in this podcast episode are those of the show host and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please check back soon for another episode of Obesity, a Disease.